Listen and stream the all-new Talk Radio Freedom 106.5 for the only talk that matter.
We welcome back to our program. Someone who's been with us here before, she's spoken to us on numerous issues, joining us again this morning. Let's say good morning and welcome to Opposition Senator Attorney Jayanti Lakshmi-Dayal. Good morning to you.
Hi, good morning, Sasha. How are you?
I'm fine. Nice to have you with us here this morning. There's a lot to discuss. Let's get straight into it. I don't think I need to allow you to introduce yourself to our listeners. They're very familiar with you. This morning, our poll question focused on Justice Stanley Jones saying to the nation that he needed 6 months to investigate the disappearance of the Vindhyan Naipaul Coolman file. Let's begin our discussion by getting your thoughts on this latest development.
So that is quite some time. 6 months is a long period of time. And I'll get back to it a little later, but particularly in the context of what the Attorney General initially said, which is that the state would like to perhaps, attempt to set aside the default judgment. In that, it's very important if you want to do that, if you're exploring that option, to act expeditiously. So that 6 month period left me a bit confused in terms of the state saying that they believe they had such a slam dunk defense to put in and they want to be able to, approach the court to set aside that default judgment. They want to explore that option. Now, stick a pin, we also have Justice Nelson being retained to advise on those matters. So I don't know how they propose to treat with on that side, if Justice Nelson will be handling that. But my thing is, and when I listen to the terms of reference of retired Justice Stanley John, to me the two there's a lot of overlap. So you can't do one without perhaps doing the other. And that 6 month period to me doesn't make much sense there. It also raises concern about, the cost to the taxpayer. Of having a retired judge retained for 6 months to do this investigation. And then, of course, I think the question on everybody's mind is, well, what is there to investigate now? The file, they couldn't find it. It has now been found. I don't think that it was ever missing to begin with. It's just someone had it. And the investigation really now is into who didn't do what they were supposed to do, when they were supposed to do it. And to me, I don't know that you need an external. You have a structure with supervisors and heads of departments and so on within the Attorney General's office. So I don't know that it's necessary to have an independent person come in and investigate, quote unquote, that sort of thing. I believe that, it's something now they know who had it. So it's just a matter of determining, well, who didn't do what they were supposed to do, and take action from there.
I'm going to ask you a question that we've discussed on the program before. Based on all that we've been told, on all that transpired, I mean, there's even been a very detailed report in one of our weekly publications, timelining all that transpired and who had possession of what and not, and then right after that, a screaming headline, file was never missing, and it flies in the face of all that the Attorney General has had to say to us. Let's leave Justice Stanley John and Ralston Nelson out of this equation. But prior to that, what we were told and what subsequently went into the public domain, do you think it's a justified question to ask whether there was a deliberate attempt to mislead this nation as to what really transpired at the Attorney General's office and their failing to file any sort of defense of the malicious prosecution case? Is that a justifiable question?
I think that's a very justifiable statement, because when the, as we say in local parlance, when the Mac bus, you saw the Attorney General come before the press in this media conference, and there was a lot of grandstanding and there was a lot of deflection immediately, and there was this attempt to, imply that there was some motive, and there was something very, what's the word he used? Sinister.
Sinister.
There was a plot somehow to cause this file. Someone may have caused it to be disappeared and things like that. And, there were certain, connotations that went with what he said. It fueled a lot of speculation that this was a real, a massive conspiracy to get this money from the state and all of that. And then as the timeline unfolded and people started reading in the judgment that, look, this is what happened when they got to the assessment, state attorneys were there, they participated, they made submissions, et cetera, et cetera. Everybody realized, well, you know, nothing the Attorney General says is true. I don't know if he spoke quite extensively at a media conference about he was out of the jurisdiction when he was told about what happened and that Minister Young was acting and Minister Young got the file and did certain preliminary investigations, et cetera, et cetera. I don't know if the Attorney General did not take the time to really understand what took place in the matter. I don't know if it is because someone had the physical file and they couldn't get themselves familiar with it. But I think a lot of what was said on that day was just deflection and public relations and the attempt to paint the state in the light of being a victim of some sort of conspiracy, which I believe at this point in time, it is fair to say there was no conspiracy. There was no sinister plot. There was no conspiracy. This is just, as far as I could see, perhaps maybe slackness and a lapse in procedures.
You're being very kind with your words. I've described it as outright incompetence. And the reason why I say that is I've never worked in a law firm, and we can describe the Attorney General's office as a law firm because they have.
It's the nation's law firm.
And having worked in the director of the public prosecution's office, which is almost the same thing, there would be chains of command for files. People would be allocated responsibilities. Once files come in, there would be reporting processes, updates, and all of these kinds of things that apparently the Attorney General wants us to believe never happen for some strange reason.
The question is, do they have those things and are those things working out well? I will tell you this. In yesterday's newspaper, you read about in the DVP's office, attorneys not going to court because of staff shortages and stuff like that. That is a problem that has plagued various departments within the Ministry of the Attorney General over time. And, you know, there was an effort to correct, but you always have proper human resource planning in the state. The second thing is that now with COVID, we were forced and take into account what happened. Everything took place during COVID when you had people working from home and all of that. So I work with other lawyers, right? And we were forced to, even though we were fairly electronic before in terms of our file management, records management, I call it, right? But we were forced to really become committed and very, very focused on ensuring that our record management system works. And it seems that that did not happen in the Administrative Attorney General, because I don't know how hard it could be to understand that during a period of time where people are working from home, people need access to the same documents, et cetera, you simply cannot have a physical document being the only copy of a document. You really do need to have electronic copies and some sort of a system that's accessible by multiple people. As simple as a OneDrive, you know, that's what we, in many law firms, that's what they do now. You have a Google Drive. So once documents are coming into your served documents, etc., documents are created and filed with the court, you will make sure that the electronic copy is uploaded onto the drive so that, you know, everybody with access to the drive can see the documents. Something is wrong with the management of records within the Ministry of the Attorney General, but they also have a problem with staffing. And I don't think we can overlook that. And perhaps that's why, and my navel string buried in the States, right? I literally grew up in the Ministry of the Attorney General. My mom worked there for 30 years. Mm-hmm. And I started my own career there, and I have a lot of sympathy for the conditions under which attorneys in the ministry work. That is not to say that is an excuse for incompetence, right? And the thing that I want to say most importantly, and why I knew that that whole sinister plot, story was not really, that was just a lot of public relations, cheap public relations, I would call it, from the Attorney General, is because it's not the first time somebody has gotten default judgment against the state. This happens from time to time. There's a Privy Council judgment on what is the criteria for the setting aside of a default judgment and so on. And it deals with the state. In the case of Universal Projects, that's the locus classicus, as we say, that sets out what is the criteria for determining whether or not the state can in fact set aside a default judgment. And it deals with the fact that, look, something was assigned, person didn't do what they were supposed to do, etc., etc. And I'll also say this, particularly with malicious prosecution cases, you depend on people external to the ministry. Now, lawyers, as much as people like to paint the picture that lawyers are the ones who bring a case or are defending a case, you could really only act with your instructions from the relevant people, right? And what I know happens a lot of times, and particularly with malicious prosecution cases, you have to get instructions from the police officers, because malicious prosecution is really someone saying to me, to the state, to the court, the police arrested me and charged me and they did not have sufficient evidence. So who could counteract that? Who could defend that allegation? It is the police. It is the police who have to come and say, this was the evidence we had. This is what we did. We investigated. We checked alibis. We did this. We did that. We did the other. We were satisfied with the evidence that we had. Sometimes you write to the police and you ask them to come and give instructions and they don't come. And you have a whole host of things happening. So this is not, the point I'm trying to make is this is not an isolated incident. It is not the only aspect of our criminal justice system that's not working. You have cases getting dismissed from the court because police officers don't show up. You have criminal matters now at risk because the DPP's office doesn't have sufficient staff to show up to court and to man all the courts at the same time. I did not get to read the article, but I see today the Chief Justice in one of the newspapers is saying, man the courts, and he expects the DPP's office to man the courts. Sometimes it just is physically impossible to get that done, but it's, they have to try and work something out, I think.
Mm.
And the other thing is that I know for a fact that default judgment in civil matters against the state, for whatever reason they don't put in a defense, it's not an isolated incident. And that's why I'm saying this is the Attorney General making this sound like this was some big, made for Netflix kind of movie type scenario where someone stole this file and hid the file and ensured that the timeline passed and, people on the outside working perhaps with somebody inside and that kind of thing. All of that is just absolute rubbish, I think. And I think in the fullness of time, that will become obvious. But what we do in Trinidad and Tobago in politics, what I've realized, and particularly this administration, is that they rely on something else to come up and distract the population. Some people call it the 7-day memory, some people call it the 2-week memory of the public. So I think that they're buying a little time, and maybe that's why they're taking 6 months to come up with this report. Because in 6 months there will be so many other things that will happen that perhaps nobody will focus too much on this.
I had asked the question when this came up as to how many other cases do we have similar to this one, and if an analysis is done over a 10-year period, how many default judgments have been delivered against the state
Yeah, on the first day, first week of the summer, we had a opposition press conference, and I threw out ours as well, and I said the Attorney General should say that instead of coming out and saying that this is some sinister plot, because again, I know that that's not the case. And I know of two cases last year involving police officers who were injured on the job, and they sued the state, and the state didn't put in any defense, and they got default judgment, and they went to an assessment, and they got damages, and the damages have already been paid. I mean, it's not $20 million, right?
Mm-hmm.
But they were paid their damages. I think one of them got close to $1 million, actually, because of it was something that had occurred at the station that caused him to be injured. And, I also said I would file, if they don't produce the information, I'm also attempting to get it through the parliament And, you know, perhaps a freedom of information request would be my next step in doing that, because I do believe that the taxpayers deserve to know what is happening in terms of how much damages are being paid by the state for default. It's one thing when they lose, and they you know, from time to time they do lose, and they have to pay costs, and they have to pay damages, and they have to pay all of those things. But if it's not even defended at all, you know, the damages are just being paid out, and it's a cost to you and to me and to, you know, all of the people in this country who are paying taxes. So, listen, there's a lot to be done at the ministry. It doesn't just, of course, you know, in the legal profession, we know the people working in there, so we have an insight into it. And I've had a lot of insight into that ministry, and I can tell you, it's records management, it's human resource planning, it's motivation, it's, you know, keeping staff retained, it's coming up with better working conditions for the staff in terms of how, you know, you manage the court scheduling, etc. A lot of what takes place in a law firm, quote unquote, and in the ministry as well, as you rightly pointed out, those departments are like big law firms for the country. You depend a lot on the non-legal staff and your administrative staff to get things done. It's the administrative staff that have to take responsibility for a lot of the steps that have to be taken when you are complying with deadlines and so on with court matters. So they need to really look at what's happening there, because we cannot continue like this. Perhaps because this case was such a, it stems from a matter that, you know, kind of rocked the country and was very high profile, and that was the kidnapping of Ms. Naipaul Coolman. Attention has been brought to this problem, but it's not a unique situation at all, and it's a problem that's existed for some time. And what I would say, though, is that when you get a claim against the state for that kind of money, some sort of additional attention, perhaps, not that all cases aren't important, but I think that the level of attention, speaking for myself, that I would have given for a case like that, where I see the kind of money being claimed and damages being claimed and the number of claimants, I find it passing strange that someone would not have, that didn't set off alarm bells in somebody's head, and they were like, okay, I really need to, you know, monitor this very, very closely and pay very close attention to it. So, at the end of the day, somebody has to take responsibility for it, and somebody will, have to face consequences. And I think perhaps in the public service, something that goes wrong really is the lack of accountability and consequences. That is where we fall down a lot in the public service. You do not have the same kind of consequences that you would have if you were in the private sector. And if we, of course, you have all these rules and regulations in the public service and all of that you have to follow for disciplinary proceedings and whatnot. But I think it's high time we do implement those things and enforce them a little bit more, because that's the only way you will ever transform the public service into a real customer service organization. And that's what we need in this country, right? Yeah. That is the government, the state is the largest customer service provider. If you look at all the different ways in which they are supposed to be serving the public, and that consequences for mishaps like this is one of the ways that, you know, I think that the private sector is able to maintain better customer service. And so that's probably what has to happen right now in the public service.
I know that we've been having some raging discussions about this, and a lot of what you've summarized in speaking about it, and basically, speaks to all the points that have been raised. I'm concerned, mm-hmm. and I had said to the people that while this is $20 million and it seems astronomical, it may be a drop in the bucket if we were to analyze whether this is par for the course at the Attorney General's office. As you've been saying, that probably needs some investigation to get the information. There's another topic that I want us to deal with, but let's take a couple calls before we get to that one. And that was a development in the Senate with the Minister of National Security and gun licenses. Hello, good morning.
Sure.
Good morning, Satish, and good morning, Senator Lakshmi-Deel. Senator Lakshmi-Deel, given the fact that you've been practicing law for quite some time now, would you, Senator Lakshmi-Deel, appear before a judge without a file, without being briefed in order to respond to a matter? And secondly, I want to ask you this question. There was a release by the Office of the Attorney General in which he stated quite clearly his source was the Register of the Supreme Court, who made it clear to him that no appearance was made in this matter. Why is it that people keep saying that appearance was made? Then the Register may have something to say about that. I listen to your comments.
All right, so let me take the second question first. When, remember, there was a judgment on the quantum of damages from the master, and in that judgment, which was the first document that anybody saw in this matter, the master said that the state did, the state filed an appearance but failed to defend. So that initially was what everybody was saying, but how, if you file the appearance, then that means somebody had the file to file the appearance, but then they did not put in the defense. Subsequently, I think the Express reported it, and the Attorney General confirmed that through the registrar, he was able to confirm that no appearance had been entered. So that is where I think that confusion had arisen. I think the master made an error in her judgment in saying that the appearance was filed, because the registrar is saying that there was no appearance. And well, that's where that is. The first question you asked, if I would appear without a file and without instructions. Let me put it to you this way. If I knew that my options were not appearing, and I would automatically, there was a high probability that judgment would be entered against me, my client, whatever it is, for my failure to do what I was supposed to do, and I needed more time, I did not have proper instructions or whatever, but I knew the matter was listed, and I knew that perhaps I was assigned to the matter, but I didn't have all the documents that I needed or something like that, I would show up. I would show up and beg. I would beg for an opportunity. I've done it before. I could tell you that much. I have done it. I would write. You have options, you know. You can write to the court and say, listen, we've misplaced this. There's something, it's just a simple application. If it was discovered that the matter was listed and that, you know, you needed additional time to put in the defense, you didn't have your instructions or whatever, you could write to the court and say something. But the point is, at some juncture, the state did have a file because they appeared in the assessment of damages, and they were electronically served with the notice of the assessment moving to the master, and they participated in that. I want to say, okay, so understanding the steps involved in civil litigation is important. You are served with a claim. It's a physical document, right? This is the document that the Attorney General said the file was open and then the file went missing, all right? When that happens, after, in the normal course of things, when you get the claim, you have a period of time to put in your appearance, and then you have 42 days to file your defense. That did not happen in this case. When that does not happen, the person who filed the claim, in this case, the nine men, makes an application, because it's against the state. You have to actually make an application and go before the judge to get the default judgment. That application was filed by the nine men. When that application was filed, it was also sent to the state by the court and the attorneys. So even if, let's give the benefit of the doubt, the initial claim had been misplaced, all right? When you find out that these nine men are going to the court and asking for default judgment, and that application was filed in November and the hearing came up in January, so you had a period of 2 months. When you realize that, you didn't say, "But we don't have this file. We can't find this file. We didn't file no defense. But they're going for default judgment. Let me call the registry in the same day. In 1 day, Stuart Young get the whole file, the whole big file that the Attorney General plunked down on the table." They could have called the court and said, listen, we misplaced these documents. We understand there's an application for default judgment. We need to get a copy of the claim now. We need to file an application and put in all you have to do in a case like that is file an affidavit and tell the court, listen, adjourn this application or do not grant this application for default judgment. We, the state, cannot locate the claim. We need an opportunity. We want time. Etc. And you go before the court and you ask for it and you put it out. Yeah, listen, the state, I would say this, I personally find judges are very lenient to the state because they themselves many of them having come up through the state, they understand the resource constraints, they understand the little chaos that sometimes happens, etc. I cannot see a judge, if the state comes to them and said, listen, we misplaced the documents, so nobody was assigned, and that's why we didn't put in this defense, and we want an opportunity now. I think any judge would have given them the opportunity, given the seriousness of this matter and the quantum, the amount of money being claimed and so on. So all of that is all of those are things to be dealt with. Sanjay, I want to say one thing. Eh? The issues we are discussing here, these are the issues that really need to be explored. As you rightly said, is this par for the course? Is this something that is a big drain on the state's resources when they are constantly paying for these quote-unquote mishaps and oversights and, as you say, incompetence, where the judgments are not, judgments is being handed down against the state because of default, and no defenses are filed. And I would have thought that if you are going to bring in someone to, quote-unquote, investigate and all of that, those are the things we should be looking at. You should have an inquiry. And the opposition has raised as well, what authority does a retired judge have to come into the ministry and, for example, interview staff and so on? One of the terms of reference that I heard, and I chuckled to myself, because one of the terms of reference is to make recommendations to the director of public prosecutions as to whether or not there was criminal conduct on the part of anyone. Justice Stanley John, with the greatest of respect, is not a police officer. And he's being assisted in this quote-unquote investigation by a retired police officer. So what happens to the real police? The real police have the authority to question people, to caution them, to advise them of their rights, to take statements from them. To if they really feel they have sufficient evidence, they could actually take them into a police station or wherever and conduct an interview with them and all of that. If Justice Stanley John went to one of the members of staff of the ministry and said, listen, I need to question you, and I believe that, you may have deliberately done X and Y and so on and so on, they could simply say, look, get out of my office. I mean, they are not obligated to speak to him. So that is another real big concern that I have with this investigation and this, I call it that puppy show, because I think that that's what it is. If you were if a commission of inquiry was set up, and it could be a one-man commission of inquiry. I know commission of inquiry has become a bad word in Trans-Vigo because of the amount of money normally associated, the expenditure associated with it. But if you're appointed, same Justice John, under the Commission of Inquiries Act, he would have certain powers.
So let's
ask... The Commission of Inquiries Act gives you certain power to do certain things, to compel people to give statements, etc., etc., and to conduct an inquiry. You have some force of law. And if the government was really serious about a real inquiry and investigation into what is going on with the conduct of civil litigation in that department, that is what they would have done.
So let me ask a question. Based on what you're saying here, because the perception, well, the perception that's being bandied about, or rather the position, is that, you know, you see the Stanley John investigation, this is a serious thing. And at the end of this, somebody going to make a jail. Because that's the impression that's being given. If as you are saying, he does not have the jurisdiction or the legal authority to advise criminal charges be laid. Because quite frankly, that's the DPP's role. When the police investigate, they go to the DPP and the DPP say, well, yeah, charge him on, and that kind of thing. So let's just say Justice Stanley John compiles this report in 6 months. And sends it to the DPP saying, I recommend this one and that one and the next one be charged.
The DPP will send... Okay, so if Justice Stanley John, I mean, he must have some basis for saying that, right? So let's just say he writes a report and he says, Mr. DPP, Ms. X had the file. She took the file home. I believe that she did so because she deliberately wanted to ensure that these men got default judgment against the state. That is somehow criminal, and he says, I believe that's an offense under XYZ Act. Now, I don't know what sort of evidence collection Justice Stanley John can do to support a statement like that, but let's just say that's what he says, all right? At its highest. the DPP will then have to send that information, whatever information Justice John gives him, to the police to investigate. And nobody ain't going to make a jail. I could say that with a lot of confidence. Nobody is going to make a jail unless the police do an investigation. If listen, to charge somebody for a missing file or for failing to do something that they should have done in within a department, whether they stole the file, so you want to charge them for what, larceny of government property, you want whatever it is, that it requires a serious criminal investigation, which neither of the two people who appeared in that press conference on Friday have the authority to do. So that is what I'm saying. This is a puppy show inquiry. That is a big, that at least on that side, on the criminal side, that's a puppy show. On the other side, with respect to making recommendations, whether they need reforms and so on, my view is that the people who are working in the system every single day, the chief state solicitor, the solicitor general, the heads of departments who have been there for forever, you know, they've been there for a very, very long time. What prevents them from sitting down with the attorney general and saying, AG, we need more staff, we need this, we need to restructure the department, we need XYZ to take place, work with us and have this happen. You need to find a retired judge to come in and take 6 months to make a recommendation. I could spend half the inside of there and tell you how to reorganize that department.
Mm.
So I quite frankly, you know, and that's why I will continue to call this the Papi Show inquiry.
Yeah. Senator, I think that's all the time that we have this morning. There are other topics that we need to discuss. So we'll probably need to have you on another day to delve deep into those, because those would require some sort of explanation as to why the Minister of National Security wanted jurisdiction over firearm users' licenses and all those things. But it's an important discussion, because the issue of firearm users' licenses is one that continues to be on the front burner in this country. So we'll have you back and we'll discuss those. Thank you so much for being with us here this morning. And for sure,
thank you for the opportunity. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. And that, of course, how we draw the curtains on our interview with opposition Senator Jayanti Lakshmi Dial. I thought it interesting, and rather not necessarily interesting, but I thought it to be important for us to get somebody who's involved and who has the legal expertise, having worked in the DPP's office and other state agencies, to give us both sides of the fence as to what could possibly have happened and why it probably would have happened and probably what did happen. So we hope that after this interview with Senator Jayanti Lakshmi Dial, you have some more information with which to arm yourself and to make decisions on your own about what you're being told, whether what you're being told is the truth and what the truth really is to you. Worrisome, though, that she is saying, when it comes to legal jurisdiction, the Stanley John investigation may have absolutely zero. Although we've had reports that have been compiled by persons who had no such jurisdiction before. And we wait to see how those unfold.
Talk is streaming at freedom106.5.com.